compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome and good morning. Thank you for listening to the Patrick Madrid Show. My number, all of you regulars already know it, but for anybody who doesn't know the number, it's 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. That's your, I can't say I've got two tickets to paradise, but that's one toll-free call to maybe what you might consider paradise if you like the program that much. So give me a call. I got a message on Twitter yesterday from a gentleman who said, I always have a very difficult time trying to call into your program. More than any other program, every time I try to call the Patrick Madrid Show, he said, I get a busy signal. So, sir, now is your moment because we do have some lines open. If you act quickly, then we can get you in and get you on the air with your comment or question. 888-914-9149. I want to begin, before we go to the phones, with mention of a story that I had brought to your attention a couple of weeks ago, and this involves a priest of the Priestly Fraternity of St. Peter, FSSP for short, and his name is Father James Jackson, and he was accused, I'm trying to think of the correct legal terms here, so he was accused of possessing child pornography. There was a server that was attached to a computer in an office or in a room near where he resided, well, in the building where he resided, but it wasn't in his own personal quarters, but nearby. And law enforcement said that he was guilty of transmitting and receiving these images. Now, for the next several weeks, it seemed rather ambiguous because although he had been charged and arraigned, he had not entered a plea as far as I was aware. And I tried to keep an eye on the story to see if there were any updates. And one arrived yesterday, and that is that he actually did plead not guilty. That's very important because I think in the absence of a plea, or at least anyone knowing about a plea one way or the other, there was rampant speculation and in some cases presumption that he must be guilty because he didn't enter a plea or maybe he pleaded guilty. The fact is, as of yesterday, and I have this from a fellow by the name of Matt Gaspers on Twitter. I saw this on his Twitter account yesterday, so I wanted to bring it to your attention. He has pleaded not guilty. And there's some documentation, if you're interested in looking at that, explaining what the trajectory is, I guess, for his case. I think this is a federal case, if I'm not mistaken. But as that story unfolds, I'll be sure to bring it to your attention. But I wanted to make sure that you knew that he has pleaded not guilty. And that's a very important part of the story. And if nothing else, I think I see it as a hopeful sign. And if indeed he is innocent, I hope he is completely exonerated. And if that's not the case, then let justice take its course. But what is that old adage? And that is that we should presume innocence until proven guilty. So that's my approach to this topic. I presume that he's innocent and he has pleaded not guilty. 888-914-9149. Let's start off with Lewis in Chicago. Good morning, Lewis.
Good morning, Patrick. How are you today?
I am doing well, thank you.
Yes, I have like a very quick question. Sure. Like on Sundays, what is allowed for someone who follows the church? I mean, can I maybe like cook on Sunday? Could I maybe do some work painting like in the house or like cutting the lawn or doing other things?
It depends. I'll give you that as my first answer. So the thing to remember is that the commandment is to keep the Lord's Day holy. In the beginning, the commandment, until the time of the church, the commandment was keep holy the Sabbath day. But Jesus gave the church the authority to transfer the observance from the Sabbath to Sunday. And so ever since the time of Christ, the church has fulfilled this commandment on the first day of the week, Sunday, the day that Jesus rose from the dead, rather than in the old covenant on the Sabbath. So that being the background, the spirit of this law is that you should refrain from all unnecessary work on Sunday. Now that would mean if you're painting the house on Sunday, but you could have painted it on Friday or Saturday, or you could paint it the following week, then you should not paint your house on Sunday. If it's absolutely necessary, let's say that your water heater, fails, and there's water all over the floor, and you got to snap to it, and you got to mop, and you got to clean, and you got to run up to Lowe's and get a new water heater. Those are all things that involve work, but that's necessary. And so you could do all those things and not violate the spirit of the commandment to keep holy the Lord's Day. But if you're thinking, well, you know, I need to get around to changing that water heater, and that's going to take 2-3 hours of work, and I've got to go up to Lowe's and get a new water heater, that's unnecessary if you could have done it at any other time, but you decide, well, I've got some free time on Sunday, I'll do it on Sunday. That would be a violation of the church's, of the commandment to keep holy the Sabbath day. And that would extend, of course, to any occupation. If you were an OBGYN doctor, and a lady goes into labor and you've got to deliver a baby on Sunday, well, you're going to deliver a baby on Sunday because that's your job. And that would also impinge upon your Sunday obligation to go to Mass. So you would not be obligated to go to Mass if you couldn't because of your occupation. You might be a police officer or a fireman or an airline pilot. There may be many ways that you can use that example. So really the dividing line, Lewis, is this work necessary here and now? I got to get it done or it'll never get done and it's urgent, in which case the church recognizes, okay, there are situations when that is certainly permissible. If, on the other hand, it's not necessary and you could do this at any other time, then don't do it on Sunday. Now, what about shopping or what about cooking? Well, certainly cooking. I mean, that's not work. I think for most people anyway, cooking can be, you know, somewhat, it could be drudgery, but it can also be a lot of fun. It could be a great time for family to get together in the kitchen and enjoy each other's company as the meal is being prepared. Of course, you enjoy the meal together. That's certainly within the spirit of keeping holy the Sabbath day, keeping holy the Lord's Day. And that leads to another area, as Pope John Paul II explained in a, I forget now, I think it wasn't an encyclical. I would need to go back and check that. But it's called in Latin, Dies Domini. So Dies, the word for day, and Domini, the word for of the Lord. So Sunday, the day of the Lord. And it's a beautiful treatise on this commandment. And what did it originally mean? And how do we observe it? And although he doesn't give you a checklist to say, these are the things you can do on Sunday and these are the things you can't do, he certainly develops for you the spirit of approaching the Lord's Day and how best to make it holy. So obviously going to Mass, if that's possible, obviously spending some time in prayer, family time, leisure, rest, take a nap. Now, what about mowing the lawn? Of course, it's going to depend person to person. I have a very large yard, lots and lots of grass, so I have a rider mower. And so for me, although I typically would not mow the lawn on Sunday, there may be some times where it's going to rain on Monday, and if I don't mow the lawn, there'll be, you know, it's going to be knee high, you know, by the time the rain stops. So I'll mow the lawn on Sunday. But for me, it's leisure time because I can put on my headphones and listen to music, unplug my mind. I can think and I can just, you know, relax. For me, it's a very relaxing thing, especially when it's sunny outside. So in a case like that, you're mowing your lawn and it's recreation, get a little bit of exercise, but it's not work. It's not something that you could have done Saturday, but you just put it off till Sunday. Those are the ways I would say to approach it. And if you take that approach and you're thinking consciously about, well, is this that I'm doing contributing to the spirit of keeping holy the Lord's Day, then you'll know, yeah, this is great. If it's something that is work that could be done at another time, then you'd say, no, I can't do that. So that's the general rule of thumb. And Pope John Paul II really elaborates on that point. Does that help, Lewis?
Yes, it does. It does because I bought like a very old house. So it needs like lots of work. It needs like painting, bathrooms, floors, windows. So I'm going to be doing some of the work, you know, and I don't have that much time. So I work from Monday through like on Friday. So like on Saturday, I do some shopping, cooking, cutting the lawn. So the little bit of time I have will probably be like on Sunday. And I do go to church and I do all the other things, but I just feel...
I would avoid that. Yeah. If I were you, I would feel uncomfortable about doing that work on Sunday because,
yes,
you know, it's not necessary. Now, I recognize it's convenient. I understand convenience. But is it really necessary? Could you rejuggle some things maybe, and get some of that work done on other days, or just say my timetable is going to be a little bit further out. Instead of being done in, you know, in 30 days, I can get done with this in 60 days and just space it out a little bit more so I can avoid working on Sunday. And the reason I say this, Lewis, quite frankly, and this is, I think, a very widespread situation, is that most people, most Catholic folk nowadays, they don't even think about this commandment. To them, it's like it doesn't even exist. And I don't blame them necessarily, because for the most part, over the last 40, 50 years, it has been so underemphasized. It has been so infrequently preached upon at Mass on Sunday, and the catechesis, to whatever extent it exists, generally doesn't place much emphasis at all on this commandment. And it is an important commandment, just like the other ones are. So to really revive one's sense of respect for this commandment, to take it easy, to rest, to avoid work that's unnecessary, spend time with family, let it go. All the other stuff that's nagging at you, just let it go. And unless there's a real necessity to do it, don't do it. And really devote that day to your time with the Lord and your own rest and relaxation. So for me personally, if I had that house and I had to work on it, I would try to make other arrangements. Oh, and one other thing, Lewis. I'm not trying to point to myself and say, hey, look at me. That's not what I'm trying to do here. But for my own part, in my own way to try to live this out, there are times when, you know, I need something done around the house, or there's a project that a contractor is going to do. And he'll say, well, I can be there on Sunday and I'll take care of it. And I'll say, no, I don't want you to work on Sunday, because Sunday is the Lord's Day and we don't work on Sunday. And usually it's like, oh, yeah, okay, yeah, I get it. Sometimes the contractor maybe doesn't believe in God and it doesn't register with him. But even to the point of having somebody over to the house to do some sort of work like that, we try to avoid anything like that on Sundays.
Yes.
So that's my recommendation.
Thank you, Patrick. Yes, of course. Thank you, and have a great Christmas. Thank you.
Thank you, Lewis. I appreciate it. We'll get a link to you for that document from Pope John Paul II, Dies Domini, the Day of the Lord. And it's worth your time. I mean, you don't have to read it all at once. There's a lot of material there. But if you wanted to, say, read a little bit every day, by the time a week or two goes by, you'll have it read, and you'll have a really clear, well-grounded, scripturally well-grounded understanding of the Church's teaching on keeping holy the Lord's Day. How about Meredith in Davenport, Iowa? Meredith, they told me that you are a kid, but I don't know how old you are. How old are you?
I'm 17, Patrick.
Oh, well, you're no kid. You're a young woman. Sorry about that.
Thank you. That's all right.
Welcome.
It's great to talk to you. I listen to your show literally every single day.
Thank you.
When I have my breakfast. And I love hearing you and Cyrus banter back and forth, and really makes my day.
I'm glad.
You're welcome. My question is, I hope it's not complicated. I have a good friend who was baptized Presbyterian, and when her parents divorced, her mom became Jewish, and her dad joined another neighbor's Greek Orthodox church.
Okay.
And recently, this friend has been really struggling with religion and spirituality, and has been coming to me and asking me questions about the faith and the church's teachings on certain issues. And she asked me if she could come to Mass with me on Christmas Eve. And I was just wondering if she told me that she was receiving communion in the Greek Orthodox Church. And I was wondering if she could receive communion in the Catholic Church, if she's been doing it with the Orthodox.
Okay. I have a feeling that the Greek Orthodox priest does not realize that she's not Greek Orthodox, because not only do the Greek Orthodox not permit Protestants to receive Holy Communion at their divine liturgy, but more often than not, they don't even typically allow Catholics to receive Holy Communion at their divine liturgy. And of course, the Eastern Orthodox churches once were part of the Catholic Church, so it's a great irony that they came from the Catholic Church with valid sacraments and holy orders, and yet very often they look down upon Catholics. So my guess is that if they realized that she was a Protestant or had been raised Protestant and was not yet Greek Orthodox, they probably would prohibit her from receiving Holy Communion. But that's beside the point. I just want to give you the background. No, she can't receive Holy Communion in the Catholic Church, but for this reason. In 1 Corinthians chapter 11, St. Paul gives two warnings, and this is the second half of the chapter. So when you get to about verse 22, 23, you can begin reading what he says about how Jesus revealed the Last Supper to him and what took place at the Last Supper. And he says, first of all, he says, no one should eat or drink, referring to communion, unworthily, or he will be guilty of the body and the blood of the Lord. Now, that is a way of saying murder. It's a euphemism. So if you're guilty of murder, if you're guilty of somebody's blood, that is about as extreme of a crime as you can commit. So he's warning here that if you receive Holy Communion in what we would nowadays call being in the state of mortal sin, and 1 John chapter 5 is where we read about mortal sin. St. John talks about there are some sins that are not deadly or mortal. So if she's, 17 years old, I'm guessing that at some point along her life, in the last few years anyway, she might have fallen into mortal sin, maybe more than once. And since she's not a Catholic, she hasn't gone to confession yet, which is what's necessary to be prepared, spiritually speaking, to go to Holy Communion. So that's the first part. So he says, if you are unworthy, then don't receive, because then you'll be guilty of the body and the blood of the Lord. The second part is, he says, don't receive Holy Communion, and I'm paraphrasing his comments, if you do not discern the body. Some translations say recognize the body. Now that can mean, among other things, not recognizing or believing in the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist. It also refers to the church as a whole, but in one aspect of it, this would refer to recognizing that it's not merely a piece of bread, it's not just a symbol, but it's actually the real presence of Christ in what once was bread and wine. Now, you know these things, I'm sure, but probably she doesn't. So that second warning says, if you receive Holy Communion without discerning the body, you are eating and drinking judgment or damnation unto yourself. So it's for this reason that the Catholic Church has, from that time forward, warn people, including Catholics, by the way, not just non-Catholics, but if you're in the state of serious sin, do not receive Holy Communion, because you're actually causing another sin, the sin of sacrilege. And if you don't believe what the Catholic Church believes, then definitely don't receive it, because you are eating and drinking judgment unto yourself. So these warnings come from St. Paul. He received this revelation directly from Jesus, as he tells us there. So it's a very serious issue. And the church wants to protect people. The church doesn't want them to be spiritually injured. And so this is not intended to shut people out, but to say, if you want to receive communion, then become Catholic. Then, if you do believe that this is the body and blood, soul and divinity of Jesus, then become Catholic, because that's where you're going to receive it. If you believe it, but you stay out of the Catholic Church, that doesn't make much sense. And when you become Catholic, of course, you can then begin receiving the sacraments, including the sacrament of confession, so that any mortal sins you might have are washed away and forgiven, and you are able to receive Holy Communion. So it's more of an invitation than anything else when it's properly understood. So as you talk to her, Meredith, I would bring up these points and share this with her and let her know that it would be wonderful if she wanted to become Catholic. The doors are wide open. You'll do everything you can to help her. It's not a difficult process, and we will welcome her with open arms. And I have a feeling that will get her interest level up even more, because she'll see that this is something that Jesus wants for her, and it's not difficult for her to receive these good gifts. And you can be her guide along the way.
Thank you. I will, that definitely helps, and I will tell her that.
Okay.
Thank you, Patrick.
You're welcome, Meredith. And last thought would be, if you can get her to listen to Relevant Radio, maybe even this program, I can help you help her. I can help you by, if she's listening, even just for a little bit every day, maybe what she hears on this program and the rest of Relevant Radio will help her move in the right direction.
I'll tell her. I have mentioned it, and she said she has listened a couple of times.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, I admire you, and I'm so happy to hear that you're helping your friend like this. And by all means, if you ever need any more advice, please call me.
I will. Thank you, Patrick. Okay.
Thank you, Meredith. Great talking to you. Break time. Let's do that now, and we'll come back with more phone calls. To the fellow on Twitter who said that he can hardly ever get in because it's always busy signals, now's your chance. We just had a line open up, so call 888-914-9149. I will be right back. Today's programming sponsored by Solidarity HealthShare. Information on their health plans available at CatholicHealthShare.com. That's CatholicHealthShare.com.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
If you're planning to fly anywhere, especially during the Christmas holiday season or New Year's or any time for that matter, you're probably familiar with that sinking feeling in your stomach when you get to the airport and it's time to go through security and you realize that your boarding pass does not say pre-check on it. And you've got to stand in that long, long line and wait and hope that you make your flight, because sometimes these airports can get so jammed, so busy that it's not always a safe bet that you're going to make your flight. Well, this is why PreCheck from TSA has been so popular. I've been a member of PreCheck for, I don't know, since it came out. I'm guessing it was about 10 years ago, maybe longer. And in order to get PreCheck, which will show up on your boarding pass, it'll say TSA PreCheck, and then you go to the really short line that goes all the way through very quickly. You don't take your shoes off. You don't have to take anything out of your briefcase. You don't have to take out your iPad or whatever. You just leave it all in there, and you leave your shoes on, and you don't go through the scanner where you have to raise your arm and they take a naked body picture of you. You don't have to do any of that stuff. You go through a simple metal detector, and off you go. It's very, very convenient, and I signed up for it when I first found out about it about 10 years ago. The way to sign up for it is you have to fill out some forms, and in essence, you're telling the government a lot of stuff about you. So you're revealing personal information, but nothing that's not, you know, standard. I mean, they don't ask for passwords for your social media accounts or anything like that. They don't even ask about your social media accounts. They want your name, address, phone number. They probably pull a credit report, I'm guessing. They do a background check, I'm guessing. Whatever it is they do, you go in and you sit down at one of their offices around the country. You have a quick interview with somebody. You do, I believe there's fingerprints involved. You give them your basic details, and then you're done. And then you get your number. And then forever and ever, amen, every time you go to the airport, your boarding pass will say pre-check on it. And you avoid that long line, and you zip right through. And I'm here to tell you, it's great. I love it. Well, this caught my eye from the Wall Street Journal. This is another measure that is going to be undertaken to keep people in airplanes from punching out flight attendants and getting up and doing whatever it is that people are doing to cause altercations on airplanes in great numbers nowadays. It's becoming a real pandemic. Haha. See what I just did there? It's becoming a real pandemic. And so the Wall Street Journal points out that the Federal Aviation Administration and the TSA have announced that if you get out of line on an airplane, and I don't mean you, because you would never do that. Obviously, you would never do that. But there are plenty of people out there who do that. They smuggle their own booze on board in some cases, and they get soused, and then they get, you know, they get into an altercation. Well, you're going to lose your pre-check status. That's the upshot of the whole thing. While it's unclear how many offenders use pre-check, the Wall Street Journal says, a trusted traveler program that allows flyers to avoid all the security screening nuisances that I just mentioned. Pre-check eligibility is reserved for low-risk travelers. That's what I am. I'm a low-risk traveler because I never bother anybody on an airplane, not that I would. And I don't smuggle booze on board. And I'm a kind citizen of the friendly skies, et cetera, et cetera. So FAA Administrator Steve Dixon said, if you act out of line, you will wait in line. That's a great line, by the way. If you act out of line, you will wait in line. The TSA will also share information with the FAA to help identify and locate unruly passengers and serve them with penalty notices. the FAA, can you imagine, you know, your flight attendant handing you, you know, pulling out a yellow card in the middle of a flight? Sorry. The FAA has initiated 315 enforcement cases against passengers this year for behavior ranging from verbal threats to physical assault on passengers and crew. There have been 5,664 reports of unruly passengers as of this year, as of December 14th. You know, it's edging up towards 6,000 incidents. Now, back in the olden days when things were more normal pre-COVID, I don't know what the standard number of these things were per year, but it seems like they were far fewer than what's going on now. The rates of such incidents, thankfully, have fallen since the start of the year, but have remained elevated compared to previous years, according to FAA figures. So that's the long and the short of it. If you have PreCheck, or for that matter, if you want to get PreCheck, which I highly recommend, if you can spare an hour, you know, to wait in line and go sit in the office where the PreCheck person talks to you for 5 minutes and you file your paperwork, it's well worth it. And every time it's come up to re-register, I guess it's come up once, I always re-register immediately because I love it so much. But if you have it, you can lose it if you're unruly. And if you don't have it but you want it, you won't be able to get it if you're unruly. FYI, that's all.
If you disobey the rules, you get cut off.
Precisely. She sounds just like the flight attendant that was on my last flight. One other quick airline-related story here, especially since it's likely that you or somebody you know is going to be flying. The Federal Aviation Administration, this is being reported by Popular Science, is warning that travel early next year could be disrupted by the latest 5G expansion. In other words, your cell phone. If you have an iPhone 12, for example, or one of the newer Samsung phones, they have 5G, and apparently that's a problem. The agency is warning about potential issues, explaining that their concerns that the frequencies utilized for this updated 5G service have the potential to impact an aircraft instrument called the radio altimeter. These sensors, which measure a plane's height above the ground, are critical to guiding pilots during landings. Well, I'll say, you don't want your altimeter to be off by even a foot. I mean, can you imagine if the altimeter were off by 10 feet or 100 feet? The CTIA, which is a lobbying group representing the wireless industry, is trying to refute these claims in an electronic filing that was sent to the FAA. They called such an analysis of the 5G operations flawed and said that nearly 400 other countries are all, I'm sorry, not 400. There aren't 400 countries. Nearly 40 other countries already using this spectrum are doing so without any issue. This includes Japan and many European countries. This organization says in some of these countries, 5G signals operate in spectrum adjacent to aviation equipment. U.S. airlines fly in and out of these countries every day. If interference were possible, we would have seen it long before now. That makes complete sense to me. On the other hand, a spokesman for the FAA told Popular Science that wireless companies in those other countries have had to take mitigating steps to address any issues, such as turning down power levels or changing antennae directions. In response to the agency's November bulletin, Verizon and AT&T both pushed back their 5G launch plans to January and agreed to reduce power levels from cell towers using this spectrum for 6 months while monitoring the change. So if you got a new 5G phone and you don't understand why it's not as strong as you thought it would be, why it's not as fast as you thought it would be, that could be one reason why. The FAA issued additional directives earlier this month outlining potentially more restrictive measures, including limiting the use of radio altimeters at certain airports where the technology could be deemed unreliable because of 5G interference. The FAA is expected to issue more specific warnings and more specific restrictions in the next few weeks regarding 5G phones and the 5G network around airports. In the meantime, airlines themselves have been predicting turbulence. CNET says United Airlines anticipates about 4% of the airline's daily flights could be diverted or canceled if the current FAA guidelines are imposed. They give some other examples, you know, from other airlines. But that, you know, technology and progress is great, and faster download speeds, that's great. But to the extent that it might impede or cause problems for the airlines, I would much rather have a slower internet connection on my phone than to have an inaccurate altimeter on the airplane on which I am flying. I think most people would make that choice the same way if they had to. 888-914-9149. Let's go to E. Frank in Astoria, Queens, New York. Good morning, E. Frank.
Yes, good morning, Patrick. I have a question in regards to the issue involving how the Roman Catholic Church and the faith celebrate Christmas with the brethren. Has it always been a fact that the Catholic Church always accepted Christmas as a Christian holiday or just a celebration of Christ's coming? Because I know that in pagan circles, Christmas has another meaning that has nothing to do with the church.
Interesting question. So the only tweak I'd like to provide here would be there. We don't need to talk about the Roman Catholic Church. It's just the Catholic Church. And the term Roman Catholic Church, I know many people use it nowadays, but it actually was introduced primarily by Anglicans in England at the time of the Protestant Reformation as a way to try to box the Catholic Church into a little cubbyhole and say, well, you know, there's the Catholic Church, but you're the Roman Catholic Church. You're like this Roman version of the Catholic Church. And that, of course, is historically not true. So that's just a little pet peeve of mine, and I offer you that for your consideration. It's just the Catholic Church, that's all. But in any case, yes, the Catholic Church has always recognized that the birth of Jesus was a very important thing. In fact, in the Gospels, we see the angels and the shepherds coming to adore baby Jesus in the manger. So there's no doubt that great importance was attached to it. But it wasn't celebrated as a holiday, certainly in the first, let's just say 200 years to be safe. For the first 200 years or so after the birth of the church, it wasn't celebrated. Easter was certainly celebrated, but not Christmas. And then eventually, and I think this may have coincided to some extent with the cessation of persecutions against the Catholic Church by the Roman Empire, and once those faded away, we begin to see this proliferation of thought and contemplation and greater and richer theological development on themes that maybe the church didn't have time to really adequately think about and do scholarship on because it was so busy from time to time being persecuted. So this is where we see the rise of the practice of celebrating Christmas. And there are various theories that include, among others, that the Catholic Church appropriated the celebration of Christmas on December 25th as a way to sort of shunt away from paganism the pagan festivals and celebrations. So sometimes they say, well, it was Saturnalia, the celebration of the false god Saturn, or it was Sol Invictus, who is the one who's, you know, the invincible or unconquerable sun, and his birthday was celebrated on December 25th. Now, there is historical research that demonstrates that those arguments are really very flawed because, for example, in some cases, that was not the day on which these festivals took place among the pagans. So my reading of the research and the scholarship on this issue suggests to me that when the church got to the point, sort of collectively recognizing that it would be a very good thing to mark this special day in the life of the church's salvation in a particular way, in a feast day, it began doing so. Not all at once and not everywhere all at once, but it became rather quickly something that the church did universally. It had already been celebrating Easter. So I would say, to the extent that you hear people saying that Christmas is just a warmed-over pagan holiday that the Catholics baptized and turned it into their own, that's not really true. It doesn't really hold up to scrutiny. And if you consider the fact that it was an organic desire on the part of the church to recognize how important this feast day is, and it just came out of that love for Jesus and a desire to show reverence to the fact that he was incarnated and born in Bethlehem, I would look at it that way. Now, if you're interested in some ready material that can give you a lot of historical details at your fingertips, you might want to start with the Catholic Encyclopedia. Now, this is the older one. It dates back to the early part of the 1900s, and so like 1906, 1907, 1908, the various volumes are coming out. But it's available for free, and you can get it online at the Catholic Answers website, catholic.com. Just go to C for Christmas and read that article, and it will give you a great deal of information rooted in the early history of the church. Does that help you, Frank?
Yes.
Great. I'm glad. Nice to talk to you as ever. I appreciate the phone call. Let's take a break and we'll come back with more of your phone calls. I have some more information, by the way, about those 12 Christian missionaries who escaped from the kidnappers in Haiti. And I've got some more details about what they actually went through to get away from that. I'll tell you about that as well as your phone calls right after this. Today's programming sponsored in part by St. Gregory Recovery Center. More information about their Catholic-centered recovery from substance abuse is available at relevantradio.com/stgregory.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Little Elvis for you. That's a nice vibe. Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show, 888-914-9149. We'll go back to the phones in a moment. First, though, I've got an update on those Protestant missionaries. As you remember, they were captured in Haiti a couple of months ago. And they escaped just recently. They got away while they were doing a shift change between the guards who were keeping them captive. So 12 of them, mostly adults, but their group also included a 10-month-old baby, a 3-year-old child, a 14-year-old girl, and a 15-year-old boy, as well as 4 single men and 2 single women. Until now, the details of their October the 16th kidnapping by the 400 Mawozo gang. In an article in the New York Times, it referred to them yesterday, and maybe it was the Wall Street Journal, referred to them as country bumpkins. I kind of prefer that name. This article, by the way, is by Beth Brelgi, and we'll get a link to it so you can read it for yourself. Christian Aid Ministries is not releasing their names. That's the group that sponsored these missionaries. The missionaries are from Amish, Mennonite, and other Anabaptist communities in Wisconsin, Ohio, Michigan, Tennessee, Pennsylvania, Oregon, as well as Ontario, Canada. Originally, 17 missionaries were abducted while on a trip visiting an orphanage. The 400 country bumpkins demanded $17 million and threatened to kill the hostages unless they got $1 million per person. After a while, they released 5 of the hostages. The Ohio-based Christian Aid Ministry spokesman, Weston Showalter, held a press conference a couple days ago and gave details of the experiences as well as photos of the former hostages. The 17 of them took a van to visit the orphanage 90 minutes from the mission headquarters. They arrived at 10 a.m. They stayed until about 1 p.m., using that time to interview the children and look at the facility. Shortly into their drive back, they saw a roadblock. While attempting to turn the van around, they were overtaken by kidnappers who chased them in a pickup truck. The kidnappers blocked their way, surrounded their vehicle, and took control. The driver was removed, and the others wondered if they would see him again. The kidnappers took over their van and drove wildly to get them to a secluded area. The workers prayed out loud and sang songs, one of which was, "The angel of the Lord encampeth around them, encampeth around about them." The hostages were taken to a small house where all 17 were placed in a small room, approximately 10 feet by 12 feet. Here they were reunited with the driver who had been taken while they were on the road. They spent their first night almost sleepless with nearly no space for all of them to lie down. In this small room, there were several mattresses. Some sat up, some stood, some laid down, and everyone endured heat, mosquitoes, and uncertainty. Soon their days fell into a pattern of worship in the morning with singing and praying, sometimes until noon. They were allowed to go outside during the day. They prayed at 1 p.m. every day that they would be freed. The kidnappers fed them, but they were still hungry. Some foods provided included the Haitian breakfast spaghetti, doesn't give a name of it, half a hard-boiled egg per person, corn mush, scrambled eggs, rice and beans with fish sauce, and sometimes vegetable paste. On Thanksgiving Day, they got a traditional Haitian stew. They were moved several times, and in one location, they had coconuts. Although they received food each day, they were often hungry, even after eating. They provided large amounts of baby food for the small children, they being the kidnappers, for which the missionaries were very happy and thankful. Babies are precious, and even the guards enjoyed talking to the little girl, Laura, The kidnapped were given basic hygiene items such as toothbrushes and toilet paper, although the supply was limited at times. They had limited clean drinking water, and they bathed in severely contaminated water that caused serious sores on several of the missionaries. Many suffered numerous bug bites that developed into serious sores from the contaminated water. They tried to soothe these sores by boiling the water and adding ashes to it and then soaking their feet in this mixture. In the evenings, they talked and sang and prayed. In times when they faced fear and danger during the night, they prayed that God would wake the believers around the world and nudge them to pray for them. And that did happen. The spokesman for the organization says, on this side, we hear of people who are awakened at night with a sense of urgency to pray. The hostages set up an around-the-clock prayer schedule, each praying for a half an hour during the day and for an hour each night. One hostage prayed in his time slot, then passed the watch to the next hostage to continue prayer. The hostages were able to develop a sense of relationship with the hostage takers. Our staff encouraged them to find another way to provide for themselves by working the land and using the resources that God has given. They assured their kidnappers of their love for their souls. They pointed them to Jesus. The hostages spoke to the gang leader on several occasions, reminding him of God and warning him of God's eventual judgment if he and the gang members continued in their ways. Various hostages wanted to attempt to escape, but it took them a while to agree on when and how. Ultimately, they unified around a plan and prayed for God to give them a sign. On several occasions, they planned to escape, but they had decided that if some specific things didn't happen, they would accept that as God's direction to wait. Twice, when they planned to escape, God gave clear signs that this was not the right time. On both occasions, on the very minute they had discussed, the exact thing took place that they had requested as a sign. God was at work, but the timing was not right. They decided to attempt their escape on the night of Wednesday, December the 15th. During the night, they put on their shoes and packed pouches of water in their clothes. They stacked their mattresses in a corner and prepared to leave. Isn't that an interesting detail? They're escaping from captivity, and they're nice enough people that they tidy up their rooms and stack the mattresses before they leave. It just says a lot of good about these people. When they sensed the timing was right, they found a way to open the door that was closed and blocked. They filed silently to the path they had chosen to follow, and they quickly left the place where they had been held, despite the fact that numerous guards were close by. In the distance, they could see a mountain feature they recognized. They had identified this landmark before, and they knew this was the direction to go. They also followed the sure guidance of the stars as they journeyed through the night, traveling northwest toward safety. Night turned to day, and after several hours of walking, they found someone who helped them make a phone call for help. Later that day, the Coast Guard flew them to Florida. Later that same day, the Coast Guard flew them to Florida. As we rejoice, the spokesman says, we also remember that many others are still waiting and praying for the release of their loved ones who are being held hostage. Many Haitian people continue to be kidnapped. Their families struggle under the demands and threats of hostage takers. Even if they are released, they find themselves facing ongoing difficulties. The hostages, for their part, they desire that God be glorified for the way he cared for them during the time they spent in captivity and arranged for their deliverance. He emphasizes the Bible verse, John 8:36, if the Son makes you free, you shall be free indeed. The Son, S-O-N. Freedom is not a place, they said. Our staff members who were held hostages would confirm that. They say that despite the difficulties, they experienced freedom, even as they were being held, facing uncertainty. In their minds and in ours, the hostage takers are the true hostages. God invites all of us, including the kidnappers, to seek and find freedom through Jesus from the bondage of sin. That is awesome, if you ask me. Love this story. Would I disagree with them theologically on some issues? Of course I would. But not with that notwithstanding, their story is powerful. And I thank God for their release. 888-914-9149. How about Jerry now in Boca Raton, Florida? Good morning, Jerry.
Good morning, Patrick. My question is the Isaiah chapter 7, verse 10. To 14.
Okay.
And if I, because I'm kind of understanding, it said, again, the Lord spoke to Ahaz. Mm-hmm. But then I look up on verse 3 itself, the Lord, which is God, saying to Isaiah, take his son and then go to speak to Ahaz. So who is actually talking to Ahaz on verse 10 itself?
So verse 3 says, and the Lord said to Isaiah, go forth to meet Ahaz, you and Shear Joshua, your son. at the end of the conduit of the upper pool on the highway to the fuller's field, and say to him, take heed, be quiet, do not fear, and do not let your heart be faint because of these two smoldering stumps of firebrands at the fierce anger of Rezin and Syria and the son of Remaliah. Because Syria and Ephraim, the son of Remaliah, has devised evil against you, saying, let us go up against Judah and terrify it, and let us conquer it for ourselves, and set up the son Tabeel as king in the midst of it. Thus says the Lord God, it shall not stand, and it shall not come to pass. For the head of Syria is Damascus, and the head of Damascus is Rezin. Within 65 years, Ephraim will be broken to pieces, so that it will no longer be a people. And the head of Ephraim is Samaria, and the head of Samaria is the son of Remaliah. If you will not believe, surely you shall not be established. Again the Lord spoke to Ahaz, ask a sign of the Lord your God, let it be deep as Sheol or as high as heaven. Okay, so in context here, we have two addresses, you might say. The one is from God to Isaiah, saying to him, here's what you're going to do. You're going to go to see this man, Ahaz. You're going to tell him what I want you to tell him. Then, beginning in verse 10, then we see the Lord speaking these words through Isaiah to Ahaz. So this is Isaiah speaking and saying to Ahaz, in other words, here's what the Lord wants you to know. And so this message from the Lord is coming through the mouth of Isaiah to this man, Ahaz.
Okay, but then if you look at verse 13,
okay.
Then he said, which is Isaiah, saying, listen, O house of Israel, O house of David, is it not enough for you to worry men? Right. Must you also worry my God?
Right. So that's Isaiah.
That's kind of throw me off.
Yeah, that's Isaiah. So we see Ahaz saying in 7:12, I will not ask, and I will not put the Lord to the test. So in other words, God is saying to him, hey, this is what I want you to do. Ask me for a sign. And Ahaz is saying, I'm not going to do that. You know, he was reluctant to do what Isaiah was telling him the Lord wanted him to do. He says, I'm not going to do that. So now Isaiah responds to him, hear the house of David, is it too little for you to weary men that you may also weary God also? So Isaiah is exasperated with him. In other words, I came all this way. I'm a prophet of God. God has a message for you. He sent me here to tell you this, and you're saying you're not going to do it? So verse 13 is Isaiah's expression of frustration and exasperation with Ahaz.
Okay, so I think my misunderstanding is that then. So I've kind of hinge on verse 10 itself. Again, the Lord said. So is that the Lord in this case, is it Isaiah or God?
Directly? Everything where it's, yeah, every place where you see, again, the Lord said, and the Lord said, and behold, the Lord said, things like that. All of those things are coming through the mouth of Isaiah. So Ahaz did not hear the voice of God speaking.
Okay.
It was through the prophet who was delivering this message.
Hmm. Okay.
You seem troubled.
Yeah, verse 13 is the one really kind of contradict verse 10.
Is
Isaiah saying that, hey, this is if the Lord saying that this is from God itself, then why would Isaiah kind of refuse? Hey,
no,
God
Isaiah
told
me
to do this, but they're not. Okay.
Yeah, Isaiah's not refusing it. Ahaz is. So,
okay.
Verses 1 through 11 tell us that God sent Isaiah to tell him this information. Ahaz says, no, I'm not going to do what God says. So in verse 13, Isaiah is expressing his frustration. I guess I'm repeating myself. I hope that's helpful to you. I appreciate your phone call. We're going to start hour two in just a moment. The number is 888-914-9149. I'll be right back.